This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Everyone, welcome back to In My Heart, a podcast truly about all the things in my heart and finding our freedoms. I'm your host, Heather Thompson. My next guest, Wendy Dio, I am so excited to have on the show. Wendy Dio is one of the first female managers in the testosterone-fueled world of heavy metal. One of the original founders of Los Angeles Women in Music and the motivating force behind Hear and Aid charity project, which raised over $3 million for African famine relief. She began managing her husband, Ronnie James Dio, called the Pavarotti of heavy metal by Jack Black. Wendy met in 1974, married in 1978, when Wendy reluctantly became his manager. We are going to talk all about that and so much more. Welcome, Wendy Dio. You're in my heart. I'm so happy to have you.
Well, thank you for inviting me. I'm very happy to be here.
So exciting. So I want to just run right into this because, man, so much has changed over, let's even say, the last 20 years, let alone when you really started in the rock industry, which was very much a masculine industry. And that was back in 1979, right, is when you started to manage Ronnie. Just bring us back there, Wendy, and start. Just give me, so correct my history.
Okay, I didn't manage Ronnie until actually the 80s because I was just a wife before that. I started managing him like in 1982 when he went out on his own in the Dio band. And myself and Sharon Osbourne were the only, well, she was Sharon Arden and became Sharon Osbourne, were the only female managers at that time in a big man's world, and they did not want us there.
Right. And I mean, Sharon, just to bring back some history to Sharon Osbourne, her dad worked in the industry, right? So didn't she follow in her dad's footsteps where you kind of came yellow bellied, truly?
Well, I did have a music background. In England, I worked as an intern for Decca Records during my summer holidays. I worked for a booking agency in England, and I worked for several attorneys in the music business in contracts department. So I did have a little background, but not like Sharon, obviously.
Right, with a history, a family history in rock management, really. So just to jump forward to the two of you, so were you comrades at the time, or were you competitors, being the two only female rock managers at the time? How did that play out for you girls?
Well, Sharon and I have been friends for a long time before we either of us were managers. We were friends.
And, how interesting! So you knew Sharon Osbourne. Anyone who doesn't know the background and history of Ronnie James Dio, I'm just going to tell you, he was considered one of the greatest voices in heavy metal music. He was the front man for not one, but three internationally successful bands, Rainbow, Black Sabbath, which is one of my favorites, and his own band Dio. He replaced Ozzy Osbourne, who was at the time known for ripping heads off bats, and Ronnie popularized the devil's horns in rock music, which is still one of the iconic symbols of rock music today, right? But he replaced Ozzy in Black Sabbath. So you and Sharon were friends when that happened. Give us a little bit of tea on that.
Oh, absolutely. Ronnie and I used to go up to Sharon's house all the time and to parties and so on and so forth. And she was one of the people, I think she's probably the one that introduced Ronnie to Tony in the first place.
Amazing. Isn't that interesting? Wow, that's a real piece of rock history right there. That is super cool. So how did you and Ronnie meet? Let's go there. Let's start from the beginning.
Okay, so I had come over to this country, to America from England, and I was looking for a job, and I worked at the Rainbow for a while as a waitress, and Ronnie came in, and because I had been known a lot of bands in England, I just knew a lot of them. When Richie came in, I knew his wife really well, and they invited me to a party after, actually Ronnie had just joined Rainbow. They had recorded their first album, but they had not toured yet, and so we went up to a party, and he followed me around, and I was said, well, he's a bit short for me. But he continued following me around. We ended up having breakfast together with a whole bunch of people, and we went on a long drive, and we spent some time together for about 2 weeks, and then he went on tour. And he called me a couple of days into the tour and said, why don't you come and quit your job and join me? And I said, well, I won't quit my job, but I'll come for a couple of weeks, and I never went back.
That's amazing. I love that story. So you started managing Ronnie. Now tell me, why were you reluctant? What was the reluctancy in managing him? Was it working for your husband? Something as simple as that, or something deeper?
A lot of things, actually. I was scared to death because he was a big star then. I mean, just come back Black Sabbath. And also because of his wife. And I got, you know, everyone's, oh, it's just his wife. She doesn't know what she's doing. All these men would say. I'm sure they said it to Sharon too, but not quite as much for Sharon because she came from her background with her father. Right. But I got it a lot, you know, oh, it's just his wife, just his wife. So, you know, and I just smiled and I would listen to what they had to say and say, oh, yes, absolutely. Thank you. And just do what I wanted to do.
Absolutely. Use your common sense and your acumen that you had before you became a wife, that you had started to, you know, compile in some of your experience. Now, women managers were really not common then. How did you manage amidst so much male domination? And I'm sure maybe you leaned on Sharon, maybe you commiserated a little bit or talked about the real bad chauvinists.
No, we didn't actually, because she went her way with Ozzy and I went my way with Ronnie.
Yeah.
And they were at that time, but no, I just did what I thought was the right thing to do and went along with it. And I think women make very good managers. A lot of women managers now. In fact, I taught management in UCLA for a few semesters, and women are just more, they can multitask, which men can't do a lot of times. They listen more. They're more caring, when I think about and a lot of musicians are like children. They just need to be helped and guided along the way. And that's what they look for.
Very true. I mean, I think women are good at a lot of things, right? Once we're given the opportunity to show what we're made of, we have a lot of great assets, you know what I mean? The female form. One of the things that Ronnie was quoted as saying about you is, I'd rather screw my manager than be screwed by them. And I think that that's a really great saying. It's nice to keep business in the family.
I'm a control freak and Ronnie was a control freak. So we butt heads a lot of times. In fact, people would run out the room when we started having an argument. Most of the time, I mean, we always worked for Ronnie's career and I never interfere with his music and he never interferes with my business side of it. So I think that's why it worked.
So you respected one another is basically what that came down to. You entrusted one another and you respected one another.
Well, Ronnie wanted me to manage, first of all, younger bands. What I wanted to see if I could, what would happen before I took him on. So we went out and found some young bands, which I started to manage as well. Then he got a little bit jealous of the time I was spending with them as well. And then there was a story where we went to Japan and the band was opening for Ronnie, Rough Cut. And they were opening for Ronnie in Japan. And of course, Ronnie was staying in a big hotel and they were staying in a smaller hotel. And I was back and forth all the time and so on. And we had flown out a very well-known journalist from England to report on the show. Well, absolutely, he had flown all the way from England to Japan, which is a long way. And I thought that the tour manager from the Rough Cut band had woken him up. And everyone thought I had woken him up. And actually, he slept through the whole show and never saw him. Anything at all by the band. And I got absolute hell for that.
Oh my God, that is so funny. I just love it. I love hearing those stories. Classic rock stories don't really belong on this podcast with you because Ronnie wasn't quote unquote that classic rock star. Like, you know, after performances, it wasn't like he was, you know, you had to worry about so much of him swinging off of chandeliers or drugging and partying and sleeping around all night. You guys really had a nice home life. It wasn't traditional rock and roll. Talk about that a little bit.
Not sex, drugs, and rock and roll. No, no. It was just a normal. Ron was a big star on stage. He's a very humble human being. Off of stage, he was a wonderful person. Everybody loved him. He could, very intelligent. He could talk to anyone from 8 to 80 about any subject that they was. He was a huge sports fan, loved animals. So our home life was mostly, you know, with the animals, him watching sports. He didn't like to go out too much because when he was home off the road, we used to have all our friends come over because we had a big, well, we still do, a big bar in the house, which we bought actually out of a pub from England. We brought it over from England and put it in the house. And it was something that we always had friends over, and I still continue to do that.
I love it. So not necessarily the quote unquote rock star lifestyle, but certainly a rock star with his own bar in his house. I love that. That's amazing. So one of my favorite stories that you shared was about as a woman, and we're going to talk about this a little bit. Obviously, there are a lot more women in powerful positions than there were, you know, in the early 80s. Even myself working in the fashion industry, I'm now 51. So I definitely got accustomed being raised in the 70s and working through the 80s. You know, I definitely have still that, you know, glass ceiling and understanding how women were treated differently and all that stuff. But you were really a pioneer in it. And one of the stories that you tell is when you got billed for some chairs. And you basically say to the guy, if you're going to bill me for the chairs, then you better ship them to my house, right? So you can share that story, if you would, with the listeners. And then if you would just expand a little bit on some of your experience as a woman and looking out as women today, what's some of the advice that you might, you know, lean in toward for a woman today based on your experience and what you know and how times are changing, but the barriers we still have to push through?
Well, my main thing about, you know, women management, especially managing rock bands, is to dress, don't dress like the rock stars. Dress like you, if you want $1 million, you better act like you look like you don't need it. So that's what I really used to teach a lot of things about. There's a lot of stuff you can learn along the way, and there's a lot of things you can't be taught. But that is one thing. Always look presentable. You're a business person, and you're going to deal with record companies and publishing companies and promoters, and you want to look like, you don't want to look like with your chains and dog things or whatever else. You got to look like you a smart business person.
Right. Dress the part, act the part, be the part. You're not the rock star. You're the business person.
The story that you're talking about with Bill Graham is Bill Graham, who unfortunately has passed away and became a very good friend of mine after this incident. But Ronnie was playing the day on the green, and it was a big festival thing and a big thing. And we were the headliner. And afterwards, I did the box office receipts, and there were like, I don't know, 12 or 24 chairs or something being charged. And I said, well, where are these chairs? Well, what do you want to know? Well, if I bought them, I want them. And it was like $1,200. And it wasn't the $1,200. It was the principle of the things that I'm being charged with something, which, where are they? Well, you can't have them. And we went back and forth and back and forth and back and forth. In the end, I said, you know what, Bill? I spent $1,200 on lunch. You obviously need it more than I do. So just keep it. Oh, no, no, no. You take it. You take it. You take it. Well, years later, I saw him and he said, you know, Wendy, you're very clever. That was reverse psychology and it worked on me.
That's so true. Your tenacity reminds me of Tina Knowles, one of my mentors, someone who I love dearly. She imparted some of that wisdom on me, tenacity, you know, looking the part, presenting yourself always, that sort of thing. That's really interesting and great advice. I love that. Music has changed so much today. I mean, you're talking about, you know, checking the receipts at the box office. Like, that's taken the door, you guys. Like, back in the day, rock bands made their money off the door. And I mean, there's a big famous story about Led Zeppelin being robbed of their door. You know what I mean? And that's really how they made money. Now, the only way really musicians are really making money, and please correct me if I'm wrong, is really from touring. Tell me a little bit about the industry and how it's changed from the days of Black Sabbath and where we are today and what you're experiencing as those shifts and maybe some of the positive shifts as a woman that you're seeing.
Well, I think nowadays there are so many bands. so much competition, and it's a real shame for a lot of young bands because there are so much competition. In our day, of course, there were only not as many bands that, you know, you've got in Black Sabbath and Led Zeppelin and a Deep Purple, you know, Judas Priest, Metallica, yeah. Motorhead. But you could, Iron Maiden, you can name them, you know, on your fingers. Yes. 1,000 bands, and they're all vying for the same slot. And so it's much, much harder for them. Although nowadays, of course, we used to have to make the album in the recording studio and whatever. Now we've got Pro Tools, all the things that kids can make a record right away. They can actually sell it themselves on the internet, which is one way of making money, which is totally different. In our day, we had to do things like, we didn't have the internet. What I used to do was I would send one of my interns with a bunch of posters and records, and they will go out on tour 2 weeks before us, and they will go to every radio station and every record store, make sure that the record store had the records in and posters up, and invite them to the show, go to the radio stations, ask them what was going on, give them tickets for the show, things like that. That those are things you had to do to bring in people, because you didn't have the internet.
Out of all the bands in the world, it was a rock band that stood up against Napster. It was Metallica, right? It was a heavy metal band, is what I mean to say. It was a heavy metal band, in fact, that turned their heads and said, this is not fair to the musician. And that was really, I think, so eye-opening for so many. And now, I mean, I can't tell you the last time I bought an album. You know what I mean? Like, everything is Spotify. Everything is downloaded that way. It's sharing music. It's sharing playlists. It's all that. And coming from the music industry myself, you know, it hurts my heart for the musician and the artist. And you're right. There are so many, like, you know, when Black Sabbath was, you know, in existence, there was no American Idol. You know what I mean? It really has changed everything so greatly that there's so much talent out there. But how do you really harness it?
I do find that the metal fans are very, very loyal. They don't like downloads. They like physical. They like to see it. They like to hold it. Vinyls came unbelievably turnaround right now. It's like so popular is vinyl. I pick out all my old vinyls I had there. I don't even have a record player anymore. You know, but it's turning around, and people are going back to what they, the you know, where they came from. Same as like the innovators of the heavy metal, you know, everybody, young bands are copying them. Young bands are playing their music. You've got so many tribute bands, which is great. It's wonderful that they're keeping the music and, you know, the music and the memories of these people alive.
Yeah, I agree. I think it's back to basics when that pendulum swings so far that we kind of have to just get back to the basics. And I think that that's right.
Hey, small business leaders. How about some help setting up those sick leave policies or administering the ever more important harassment and discrimination prevention trainings that comply with state and local requirements? Well, JustWorks is here to help. JustWorks is the ultimate HR platform for small and growing businesses. Take the guesswork out of managing employee benefits and figuring out state-by-state rules and compliance, and get access to national large group health insurance plans, handle payroll and PTO requests. JustWorks makes it all simple. You can hire and onboard new employees with ease, manage your remote teams, and run your small business with confidence. Find out how JustWorks can help your business by going to JustWorks.com. That's JustWorks.com. For more information, JustWorks.com. They're there for your small business. This podcast is sponsored by BetterHelp Online Therapy. We get our cars tuned up to prevent bigger issues down the road and annual checkups, and we hit the gym to maintain physical wellness, and we clean up around the house regularly to avoid a giant mess. Going to therapy is like all of this. Routine maintenance for your mental and emotional wellness to prevent bigger issues down the road. Therapy doesn't mean something's wrong with you. It means you're investing in yourself to keep your mind healthy. BetterHelp is customized online therapy that offers video, phone, and even live chat sessions with your therapist. You don't have to see anyone on camera if you don't want to, and you don't have to sit in a waiting room. BetterHelp is more affordable than in-person therapy, and you can start communicating with your therapist in under 48 hours. why invest in everything else and not yourself. This podcast is sponsored by BetterHelp, and In My Heart listeners get 10% off their first month at betterhelp.com/inmyheart. That's BetterHelp.com/inmyheart. Dipsy Stories is an app that is full of sexy audio stories and new written stories. So no matter who you're into or what turns you on, Dipsy helps bring to life the stories you want to hear and write from your phone. Get lost in a world where your pleasure is your only priority. Explore your fantasies in a safe and shame-free way. There are hundreds of stories to choose from. And Dipsy, they release new content every week, so there's always more to explore. They even have wellness sessions to help you wind down and explore, and sleep sessions to help you drift off. For listeners of the show, Dipsy is offering an extended 30-day free trial when you go to dipsystories.com/inmyheart. That's 30 days of full access for free when you go to dipseastories.com/inmyheart. It's important to seek out pleasure in every area of your life. That's dipseastories.com/inmyheart. Ronnie's memory, you know what I mean? The loss is loss. I mean, the year he got diagnosed with cancer was the same year you lost him. It was so much so quickly for you. And I know that he was in the middle of writing his memoir, and I know how painful that must have been for you to finally pick it back up, which you did, and finish this story. Can you talk a little bit about that journey and what Ronnie set out to do and what you were able to complete for him?
Well, he started writing the book, I think it was like late 80s, early 90s, but it wasn't anything, you know, that he was rushing about. He'd write a couple of chapters, handwritten, bring them into the office, go and type them up. He'd go on tour, and then he'd come back and write a bit more and so on. And that's how he did it. And he wrote, and I actually had a publishing deal for him while he was still alive. When he was sick, he scribbled a lot of stuff, and he also would go on the computer and type bits and pieces that I want to remember to put in the book. He didn't think he was going to pass away. I my wildest dreams. I mean, 3 weeks before he passed away, he was picking up an award in LA. And, you know, that was 3 weeks before he passed away. And I just thought he was going to beat it. We used to go to Houston every 2 weeks for his chemo. And we used to skip down the hall saying, "We're going to kill the dragon. We're going to kill the dragon." Because one of his albums is called Killing the Dragon. And we called the cancer the dragon. So that was, you know, anyway, so. When he passed away, well, obviously the publishing deal, I didn't want to deal with it or anything. It was way too soon. As the years went by, people kept asking me about the book because Ronnie had been talking about it. And I said, well, yeah, well, maybe we'll finish it one day. Maybe we'll finish it one day. And Mick Waugh, who's a journalist from England and also has many, many books behind him, he was a great friend of Ronnie's and mine, and had interviewed Ronnie many, many times. So he said, "Wendy, you got to get that book out." "Yeah, but I need help." He said, "I'll help." I said, "Okay." So we talked about it for a while, and then I decided that if we're going to put this book out of Ronnie's, I wanted it to continue in Ronnie's own words.
Yeah.
So we took the scribbles that he'd done, and we went and researched that, and then we went and we found all the interviews he'd done at those particular times that in his life, and so we tried a lot of it to still continue in Ronnie's own words, and that's how we completed it. It's like 11 years now since he passed away. So
I can't believe that. I can't believe it's been 11 years already.
11 years, yeah.
How long did it take you to actually pick it back up and finish it?
It was probably in the last couple of years.
So Rainbow in the Dark is the autobiography. That's what it's called, Rainbow in the Dark. And it's illustrated throughout with photographs. Oh, it's beautiful. I'm so glad I'm seeing the cover. There he is. I love him. Oh, my God. Amazing.
Where's the photographs? Going through the photographs, because I didn't want to have the normal stage shows and so on. I wanted some personal photos. And that, I think, was the hardest part, because I remember every single place we were at when those photos were taken and everything. So,
well, that is beautiful that you have those memories, because a lot of the rock wives didn't even know what was happening there. And my, you know what I'm saying?
I love autobiographies, and I happen to love rock and roll, and I happen to love music and those autobiographies of musicians. So I cannot wait to dig into this one, from Eric Clapton's to Keith Richards to Fleetwood Mac's to everybody's autobiography of rock I have read. They all cross paths. You know, that time in music was so unbelievably important. All those rock bands coming out of London, you know, the influence of, you know, the blues musicians, you know, here in the States, like that coming together of all that. There's every book has a story about how they interplayed, obviously Ronnie and Ozzy's story. And it's all so cool. So I cannot wait to read it. And I got to tell you, the my favorite part of those books are the personal photos that you guys share. So I'm so glad that you did that. As painful as it was for you, you're bringing so much joy to share that with everybody. So I'm so glad that you did.
Thank you. And I read Rob Halford from Judas Priest book recently, and that was amazing because, well, for me, a lot of the places he talked about, I remember from my childhood, but also the heartwarming way of him coming out and having to tell people that, and what he went through in life of not being able to admit that he was gay. And it was very, very touching for me. He's such a wonderful person and such a good friend. And I was, the book made me cry, actually.
So inspirational to share the stories of the journeys of these people. I find that Patti Smith's book did that to me, just kids really talking about her honesty, you know what I mean? And her struggle. I think that they're huge. And those artists, you know, like Ronnie and, you know, the ones that we're talking about, that artism, it comes from emotion, it comes from passion, it comes from heart, it comes from pain, it comes from struggle. And it's super cool that we're going to be able to get to read that. Now, not only is Rainbow in the Dark an autobiography, but there is also a career-spanning documentary of the life and times of your husband, the legendary rock icon that he is, about Dio, to be fully authorized by you, right? And so have you been able to see any of that? Is it authorized? Are you able to join in on it? Tell us a little bit about it.
I'm definitely in on it.
Yeah.
I'm working with these guys from 914 Films and great guys, Don and Damien and Sheena. And they're just fantastic. I'm having such a good time with them. And I saw the first cut of it actually 2 weeks ago. And I was there with my publicist, Sharon Weiss. It's financed by BMG Records. And one of the people, Kathy from BMG, was there. And we watched it. I cried my eyes. I looked over and Sharon's crying and then Kathy from BMG is crying. It was very, very, very emotional, but very well done. Totally different to the book, completely different, because the book finishes in 86. This book goes from the beginning right to the end. And
that's so good to know.
Eddie Trunk and Rob Halford, Glenn Hughes, all these have Lita Ford. They're all talking about Ronnie and telling their stories as well. So it's very, very interesting.
Oh my God, Lita Ford was one of my favorites. But first I want to talk about Jack Black for a second. Can you tell us the story of how Jack and Ronnie had this mutual admiration for each other and how that relationship started?
Well, it started with Jack, Tenacious D, put out a song called Pass the Torch. And everybody was saying it was about Ronnie. And they were all afraid for Ronnie to listen to it because they saw Jack was saying, pass the torch. Right? So I played it to Ronnie and he thought it was hysterical. He said, I love this guy. I got to get hold of this guy, whatever. So we were doing an album and there was a song called Push in it. And Ronnie said, call Warner Brothers. I want him in this video. So I called them and we set up the meeting with Jack's management, and Jack and Kyle came down and played Buskers in Ronnie's video. And they got on so well, so unbelievably well, that then Jack, when he was doing The Pick of Destiny, this movie, he called up and said, I really want Ronnie in it. And he actually wrote this whole thing saying, you have to be in the movie, you have to play yourself and everything. So Ronnie did, and they had such a good time together. It was amazing. And actually, there's a bit in the documentary where Jack talks about it.
Oh, good. I mean, there's nobody quite as magical as Jack Black. So diverse, so dynamically talented and entertaining. He's got an amazing voice.
Amazing voice, yeah. Mm-hmm.
So Wendy, for those of you listening, like, I want her to manage me. She doesn't take on new clients, but I know you're never going to retire. You're still so passionate about it and you're still so involved in it. So just tell us a little bit more about that, because when you do what you love, it's never work, right? It's only work if there's someplace else you'd rather be. So you've actually made a career out of a passion that you didn't even know you had.
You know, I have to keep Ronnie's music and his legend alive. So we do that in every way possible. We tie up with our charity as well. So we do the Ride for Ronnie, which motorcycle ride, usually on around Ronnie's passing, which is May 16th. Obviously, we couldn't do it last year, but we're hoping to do it next year. And it's about 350 motorcycles, and Harley Davidson sponsors us, and it's amazing because they close the freeway and they have the police motorcycle on the side, and it's just amazing. They come in and then we have this big it's like a family affair. That starts in the morning, then we have a entertainment in the park with whoever's going to show up. We never know because nobody gets paid, so they all just come and volunteer, and all the money goes to the Ronnie Jones Deal Stand Up and Shout Cancer Fund.
That's amazing.
In the fall, we do a bowl for Ronnie, which is celebrity bowling. Usually Jack plays and Tom Morello has his own ball. So many people come, Dave Grohl, or everyone you can think of who's in town comes, and they do celebrity bowling. And we do this auction where anyone can bid on it and they can bowl with the celebrities. And it's a really fun evening, makes money for the charity. We do that. And next year I have Dio Band going out in March. With some special effects. It'll be film of Ronnie and special effects. They go out. I think Warner Brothers is bringing out 6 more albums, re-releasing them. And we have been in the vault looking for bonus material that people haven't heard before. I've got BMG bringing things out. I mean, it's never ending. Other people that I'm busy doing, I manage Ainsley Dunbar. I don't know if you know who he is. A very famous drummer, the most famous drummer, I think, played with everyone in the world. I'm doing a big publishing deal for him. And then he's writing a book, which I'm helping him with.
I want to say 2 things. I'm going to digress. First, what I want to say is, you know, death is so difficult for us, you know, as the living, even though it's a part of life. And we all know that death is as much a part of life as living. It's so final. And what you miss is that human form, that piece that you fell in love with, the touching and being near him. But this is a perfect example of how once you know someone and the soul has lived, they never go anywhere. They may not be here in the human form, but you are celebrating and constantly still moving forward in your life with Ronnie. May not physically be at your side, but he's right there at your side and all these memoirs and all the gifts that you're giving. So once someone's able to touch you in your life, whether they're with you physically or not, they never go anywhere.
Yeah, I do. I feel a lot of times in the house, especially in the studio. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think that that's amazing. And then I wanted to say, so the first rock band that I ever really totally fell in love with, like I was like, I have got to be, you know, I'm going to be a roadie. I have to follow people was Zeppelin. So they were my first, you know, I fell in love with Zeppelin. I'm still to this day a fan. And I actually went on to tour with Robert Plant later in life. I got to know him later in life, which was such an amazing gift. I love you, rock and rollers, and I thank you for your memories and your continued legacy. Thank you so much for being on and sharing a little bit of your story and certainly that of Ronnie. So I like to ask everybody, we find freedom in all different ways and walks of life, and someday freedom could mean one thing to you and the next day it could mean something else. How do you find your freedom and continue to exercise that for yourself?
Oh, well, though, I love my charities. I love my charity work. I love to do things. I love the animals. I love to help the animals. We do a lot of stuff with the animals. Ronnie used to do it too. I go in a cage once a year. About 30 of us friends go in there at the Brittany Foundation, and we have to stay in the cage for 24 hours. It's $1 a minute to get us out. Luckily, I have a lot of friends, so I'm usually drinking champagne and eating eggy sandwiches outside trying to get the dogs adopted. And that's I love to do that. I love to do that. I work with Freedom Foundation, which is teaching kids about American history, recognizing people who've done something good for the world and honoring them. There's different things. I love people. I love to talk to people. I love to work with people. And I just, you know, those are the things I love to do.
I love it. And I've loved talking to you so much. I want to thank you so much to my guest, Wendy Dio. You are in my heart always. For those of my listeners who don't follow you already, where can they find you? Where can they lean into some of the things coming out on Ronnie? Just give us the 411.
Just on the site, Dio, it's just Dio site. Just go type in Ronnie James Dio. You'll come right to the site. And we have Twitter and Instagram and all those things. I don't quite know how to do them myself, but I have people that do them.
Absolutely. Well, the legacy lives on, and so does all the love. And thank you for being a pioneer and really setting the stage for women that have come after you, and for continually leaning into the work and the charitable efforts, and for sharing Ronnie with us continually. Thank you so much for having me, Wendy. You're in my heart.
Thank you so much for your support.